Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, again, two back-to-back conversations this time. The first one is the longer audio version of an interview that I gave recently to the awesome Laura Polacco, freelance journalist who in this case interviewed me for the Japan Times. We talk about a rather niche topic of Akiya rentals as opposed to purchases. Is it okay to rent an Akiya property directly from the owner without an agent involved and potentially even without a lease agreement in place? Who does that work for and who should be a bit more wary of the arrangement? What should the strategy be regarding insurance and liability in these cases? What are the dangers and risks involved? And a whole lot more. So a rather short but very interesting conversation. Have a listen and I'll see you again with the second conversation on the other side.
So thank you very much. So yeah, we're writing a piece about IKEA rentals, which is something that I stumbled across when I was in Kochi. There's a couple there who rent an IKEA that had been empty for several years. And the Japan Times is very interested in that because IKEA is obviously something that has grown in fascination amongst foreigners for a while. But a lot of people see it as a traditional buy the whole property and you own it. And the renting it is a slightly different look at getting into that market, should we say. So we already have quite a long piece written that I'm editing down. And we also have some input from Parker J. Allen from IKEA and Inaka as well on his... Yes, his input on it. So we're just looking really for some more professional opinions on the whole concept of renting IKEA. Is it something you've come across?
So I guess my first question, we've definitely come across people who are renting old houses, whether they were originally IKEA or just something that the owner is still more involved in. Because with IKEA, normally the owners would be either absentee or passed away, and it might be just their kids holding on to it. So I don't know that any of the properties that I've seen people renting in the countryside were necessarily IKEA, but the profile of the property is probably similar. Mm-hmm. I guess you mentioned as an alternative to the buying them yourself. Mm-hmm. When you say as an alternative, in what way? Just a place to live or to run a business or to do what with?
Well, place to live primarily. I know that someone else I spoke to who's renting an IKEA is looking at maybe making a little bit of a business out of it with permission from the landlady, of course. But primarily for this article, just as to reside in.
They're cheap rentals, so I guess it's like any other decision whether to rent or buy. How long do you think you're going to be staying there? How easy would it be to renew the lease if and when you need to? Because if you're running a business, obviously you're more susceptible to issues if the landlord wants to suddenly raise the rent or not. Not renew the lease, because that would affect your business. If you're just renting it to stay, then you just tend to move, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes. So
I don't see the dichotomy between renting an IKEA as opposed to renting a normal place to live. If you like the countryside and you like the feel of these old homes and you're the DIY type, then I guess why not? But I don't know what other aspects to their to that topic are there?
So what we're talking about, so I mean, that was initially my thought. And obviously it comes with caveats. So, and this is what I was talking about with Parker, was that a lot of the rentals that I've come across are mainly, they're found through word of mouth. So people know the people. So people get connected to the IKEA because they know someone in the area already, or they've been living in that area for a while already as it is. But the contracts tend to be quite verbal rather than formal legal documentation. And Parker was warning that there are dangers when it comes to that, such as legal liability issues, you know, miscommunication as to who's in charge of what. So in the case of some of the people I've met, their landlady lives in assisted living. She doesn't come out to the apartment. They don't ever see her. They're in charge of maintaining the property and adding to it. It's completely on them. Whereas in other properties, it might be slightly different. So it's sort of a case of, we want to inform our readers of, as well, the positives of like renting in IKEA. Like, we don't want to mislead them into believing this is like a perfect solution, because it comes with caveats and potentially even like some legal dangers.
I would definitely say that number one, you want to get a proper rental lease in place. I know that people are maybe thinking about it as an alternative to going through an agent and paying the fees that normally come with agents. But again, if you're doing that, you're doing it as a personal kind of arrangement between you and somebody else. You're definitely not going to have the protection that you would have by law with a normal rental lease. And there are templates for normal rental leases in Japanese. Obviously, the landlords in this case wouldn't be able to do it in English, but there are templates for rental leases that you can just download off the internet.
Okay.
So even if you're not going through, even if you're not going through an agent, it's probably very important to put one of those in place.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, I think it's because of the nature of IKEAs and the owners of IKEAs, the arrangement could potentially be a lot more temporary than you would with a normal rental. For example, the owner suddenly changes their mind, they move out of the city, they want to sell the place, the IKEA bank in the local municipality convinces them to sell the place. So I'd say it's probably a good solution for somebody who's looking maybe to save some money or try some things out, but are able to then move out if the situation occurs that they have to. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're renting a proper place from a proper agent with a proper lease, then you obviously have, again, the protection of the two-year renewal that is kind of semi-automatic in most cases.
Okay.
And also, like, I have a friend here in Fukuoka City who's got a verbal arrangement with a local IKEA owner to rent, I call it rent, but it's a very, very small amount, to rent out the place and try to run a haunted house in it. So they're opening up this Halloween and they already done the place up. And, you know, IKEA kind of lends itself to this atmosphere, but they're very aware that it's a temporary arrangement that may or may not succeed for them. And, you know, that the lady may or may not at any time change her mind. They're not, how to put it, I wouldn't bank on it being a long-term solution. So if that's something that you're looking for, you and your family to reside in for a number of years, I definitely do it the proper way with a lease in place.
Mm-hmm. I think this is something that, in my opinion, sort of appeals to perhaps even younger foreigners that are coming to Japan who potentially want to do some remote work or are able to do remote work. So I know the couple that live there. One of them works locally as a blacksmith, and the other one, she does remote work from her laptop, so she can be wherever. So in that case, living deep out in the like Inaka of Kochi works for them. Obviously, if you are needing to be in Tokyo on a regular basis, it's probably not going to work for you. But
it's not exactly what I mean. I mean, yes, definitely, if you want to live in the countryside, then that might present itself as a solution. But there are also normal houses for rent out in the countryside that come with a normal lease.
Uh-huh.
What I'm saying is that, yeah, like the digital nomad type that you've just described, the remote worker, people with small or more mobile families or no families at all, definitely. But even if you want to live out in the countryside and you've got a family of five and you're going to register the kids to school and you're going to be living in a place where you're planning to set down roots,
mm-hmm.
make sure that it's something that will be with you for at least the long run, medium term, if not the long term.
I see.
Because if you do it verbally or with just a handwritten kind of memorandum, you're just not going to be able to do much in case you suddenly have to uproot and leave.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's more the aspect I was concerned with.
Okay, yeah, for sure. So another question I wanted to broach on quickly was, what do you think? I mean, obviously we've talked about the legality of living there and having, you know, if you've got a verbal contract, you might move out at a moment's notice. But one thing that my editor was interested in was what dangers arise when, in terms of like stuff like liability. So say you have a couple that have not a contracted rental and they're just living there and something happens with the building and one of them is injured. It's a case of where the dangers of where does the responsibility lie? Does it lie with the owner whose property it legally is? Or I don't know if you have any insight on that.
Normal tenants in normal rental situations are not obliged, but very strongly advised. And some landlords will refuse them if they don't take out a personal insurance for themselves and their belongings.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually not going to be on the landlord. The landlord needs to take out insurance if they want to insure the property itself. But in those cases, if it's clear that the tenant, you know, is the source of the damage to the property, then the tenant would be liable, whether the owner took out insurance for the property or not. And vice versa, if the tenant doesn't secure themselves with the personal and personal belongings insurance policy, that it's going to be very difficult to put it on the landlord.
Okay, so the people renting, no matter what, really, regardless of whether it's a key or regular, getting a personal insurance is recommended.
Yeah, tenant. I think the official term was tenant insurance or tenant fire insurance, but similar to a structural insurance, they call it fire insurance, but it covers all sorts of damages.
Yes, and I remember paying that when I moved into my first place. The fire
exactly.
Insurance. Yeah,
so you want to get that regardless of which property you're sitting in, because even your rental lease doesn't secure you from doesn't mandate any compensation by the landlord. That's something that you have to insure yourself for.
Okay, even if it's something like structural with the building that the tenant was unaware of, it still doesn't fall on the landlord.
They could try to file for compensation from the tenant's insurance policy. And, you know, Japanese insurance companies are a little bit better than overseas insurance companies in that respect, but I definitely wouldn't count on them being covered. You want to take out your own policy whenever you're renting a place.
Okay, yeah. It's just with
a key. Or when you're buying a place, for that matter. I mean, if you buy a place, you're also going to be taking out a separate insurance that doesn't cover the structure, but covers yourselves and your belongings because they're not on the same policy.
Okay. Okay, that's interesting to know. That's good for me.
I'm not saying they don't have a legal leg to stand on. I'm just saying that it would be a lot easier if they would insure themselves.
Okay. Yeah, because with IKEA, obviously, with a fair few IKEA, there is obviously in some cases structural damage to the property. So the chances of potentially injuring yourself whilst, you know, either doing renovation work or just from something being wrong with the property is potentially higher than with a regular rental that is obviously, you know, above board in terms of structure. So it is something that people need to be aware of when they move into IKEA, is that the property is safe or that they were aware of issues prior to moving in.
Absolutely. But I mean, Japan being Japan, yes, IKEA's, you know, tend to be more susceptible to this kind of thing, but it's Japan, right? You could live in a beautiful new, brand new house and still have it all come down around your ears in an earthquake, right?
So yes. Yeah. Obviously. Yes. Yeah.
Now, if you've been following this podcast for a while, and in particular our JREP sessions, you're probably more than familiar with Blanca Kobayashi of Arc Reform. They're a bilingual renovation company serving clients in the Kanagawa and Kanto area, so Tokyo, Chiba, Saitama, Kawasaki, Yokohama. They can handle simple, small-scale projects as well as full house renovations, and they will work with you on the perfect design for your dream family home. But not only homes, Arc Reform also handle commercial property renovations, offices, restaurants, bars, shops, you name it, from traditional classics to the latest trends in interior design and renovations. So you want to email them for a free consultation and quote at info@arcreform.com. That's ARKReform, all one word, .com, and give your home or commercial space the love and care that it deserves.
Yeah. So do you know if there are companies that are filling this sort of gap in the market? Because I do know there's a fair few companies that are like IKEA and Dinaka that will help with the buying process, but they don't deal with rental purely because for them, they said the it's too complicated for them in terms of like who is in charge of what. So they just leave that side of things alone and focus purely on purchasing IKEA. Do you know of many places that deal with renting, acting as a middleman between owners and renters for IKEA properties?
I'm not aware of any. And again, because of the nature and the locations of where these properties are usually located, I'd say it would probably be local rental agents that deal with that. I don't know that any company will do that on a national basis unless they have a really good sort of working model in place. But again, there are plenty of these available for normal rent in most locations. So even if that particular little village doesn't have a real estate agent, the nearest big city will have an agent that covers these areas as well.
Okay.
There might not. I mean, yes, a lot of them are done verbally because people want to avoid the middleman, but I don't think it's such a good idea, especially with all of this vagueness involved.
Yeah. I think one of the people I talked to who lives in Ehime, she said that the government have a, so obviously government municipality run IKEA banks will have purchase prices for a lot of their IKEA, but they also do share rental prices. I've been looking online and I've been places that are more commonly resided in by residents, such as around Tokyo, etc. And I've struggled to find places that list both the purchase price and the rental price. It does seem to be the municipalities that are way out in the countryside that are trying very hard to promote their IKEA properties. I do know of one.
I would assume that in these cases, similar to the purchase, they have an appointed real estate agent who's going to handle a tenancy lease like they handle a purchase contract, right? They're not just going to put you in touch with the owner and go do your thing.
Okay, yeah. So in your opinion, it'd be worth, even if it doesn't have a rental price, it'd be worth getting in touch with whoever is managing the property or managing the purchase and to see if they'd be open to rental.
Yeah, so the local IKEA bank will put you in touch with the appointed agent who's going to be handle the sale of the property, and then you just contact them and you ask, hey, you know, would the owner be willing to consider renting it out instead of that? But I'd still go through an agent.
Okay, yeah, great. I'm just trying to think.
And I'm not saying that because we're not agents. There's nothing in it for us. I'm saying it just from an angle of protecting yourself as a tenant.
Yeah.
So there you go. Interesting concept that, as Laura mentioned, plenty of people are already involved in it in various formats. I personally would love to revisit the topic in the near future and maybe get some more updates and insights on this trend. Now, the second conversation, also on the topic of IKEAs, but this time regarding purchases and short-term rentals of those properties. So I spoke to a new potential client who's looking into buying an IKEA in Izu Peninsula to use as a holiday home and potentially for retirement into at some stage. And he was wondering what he'd be able to get and at what price ranges, how feasible it would be to rent the property out when he's not using it himself, what we'd be able to assist him with and how we charge for our services, and also some other more niche topics like, for example, onsen and resort properties, land ownership, restrictions on foreign ownership, locations that would potentially do better or worse for short-term rentals, purchase costs, procedures, and even the ability to designate a property that he owns as a non-smoking property. We also touched just a little bit on the topic of straight-out property investment in Japan, how that compares to other investment assets, what types of investors would it be suitable for, and more. So a really nice chat on a variety of topics. I hope you found some value in it as well, and I'll see you again just to say goodbye on the other side of this one too.
Okay. So, I mean, I think we've answered most of your questions regarding IKEA and whatnot. You had some, you wanted to have a discussion about strategy, investment versus holiday home.
Yeah. Look, I'll give you just a quick background that, you know, I'm looking at retiring in a year or two, hopefully. I'm not so concerned about investment as lifestyle. So the idea was to look at probably an IKEA that I could do up, possibly rent it out part of the year during the tourist season. I'm interested in the Izu Peninsula, but I think it's got potential. And so I just had the biggest question I had that I didn't get my head around was that, yeah, I'm not really an investor, but let's say you buy a property for say $50,000 and it gives you a return of 5%. So that's $2,500 per year and you own a property. At the end of say 5 to 10 years, you sell the property, but in Japan, it doesn't really appreciate much in value and you get your money back. So compared to, say, investing in an ETF or some sort of index that might give you 10% and you can cash in any time, what I don't see what the advantage is in the buying apartments. Does that make sense?
When you compare it to something generating 10%, it definitely makes sense. But people usually come to invest in property for a bunch of other reasons. So normally it's considered, I'm not sure what sort of equity or ETF or fund investments you've got access to, but people have occasionally reported that that projected 10% has actually gone down to zero for a few years and then climbed back up to 4%. So it's not as... I wouldn't call property investment guarantee. I don't think any investment is guaranteed, but it seems to be a bit more safe and stable yield-wise. So the way people usually think about it in their minds is a term deposit is probably a guaranteed return of, you know, 1 or 2 or 3%, then property investment somewhere between 4 to 7%, and then other investments can potentially yield more, but also can fluctuate a lot more, right?
Okay.
The other advantage, the other reason that people get into property in addition to other investment classes is just to diversify. They don't want all their eggs in one basket. They don't want to have exposure only to a single type of investment. And then they hedge or diversify with property investment as well. And also property can be insured, which is not something you can probably say for other vehicles, right?
Sure. Okay. All right. Well, that makes it a bit clearer. But in my case, because I'm looking more at a lifestyle thing and I'm looking at possibly living in Japan, at least initially for a couple of months a year, and with a long-term view of having something there that my daughter can use in the future, I'm probably more interested in the Akia idea rather than apartments for rent.
And well, Akia is going to be challenging for rent for a from a few aspects. The first is that the property has to be in a good, presentable condition for people to want to stay in it.
Right.
If you're buying something for 30, 40, 50,000 Australian, that's pretty much a shack in the woods kind of property.
Yeah.
So there will be some extensive work required, which can often come up to 2-3 times the price of the property just to bring it up to rentable condition.
Okay, yeah.
That's number one. Number two is, depending on the location, to rent them out short-term, you need a short-term stay property manager. And they just don't set up shops out in the countryside because there's no business for them there.
Okay.
Well,
when I say countryside, I mean, my wife is from Shizuoka prefecture.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking at the...
Izu Peninsula, you mentioned.
Izu Peninsula, right? Yeah. Which is what, a couple of hours from Tokyo, I suppose, rather than being right out in the boonies, although maybe that's considered out in the boonies, I'm not sure.
Well, there are property managers that can service this area potentially. Whether they'll take it on or not depends on how profitable they think it might be. I can only, because we're acting as your proxy, so we give you a single point of contact, English speaking, and then we go ahead and enlist the assistance of these property managers or renovation experts or whatever the job is that needs to be done. So we can testify to property managers that we've worked with within Tokyo, Osaka, Kyoto, and Fukuoka, which are the cities that are most popular and easiest to get short-term stay guests in. We do know of the existence of short-term stay managers in other parts of the country, but we can't let you know how efficient they would be before we've actually trialed them out. So it's very much an unknown from our perspective. Normally what our customers in your situation do is they have a holiday home and, you know, they get the best that they can get at their budget. And then they try to, if possible, rent it out when they're not using it. And if not, it's okay, but it's more a case of covering costs. It's not going to be a big income stream.
Oh, sure. And that's all I was really concerned with more than anything. So that's not really a problem from my point of view.
But the other thing is that if you own an entire structure, aka a house, then you don't have the buddy corp fees and the owner union taking care of the structural and the reserve fund and so forth. So everything that needs to be done structurally is on you.
Mm-hmm.
And again, with the budget you've specified, you're probably looking at something that's at least 30, 40 years of age, which means on average, it's just a statistical number, but on average, somewhere between $3,000 to $4,000 a year in annual maintenance and repairs.
Okay.
I don't know that your short-term rentals will cover anything as near that. So if the backyard or garden or the, you know, the countryside location is a big thing, then, you know, we'll help you get whatever you want to buy. So you're the boss. I mean, we'll help you buy whatever you want to buy. But if you were looking for something where you wouldn't have these, you know, unexpected and sudden surprises with structural maintenance, I'd definitely steer you towards a condo unit.
Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake, which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily. Ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties, Akiya Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiya Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's A-K-I-Y-A-M-A-R-T, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today.
Okay, and... but you can handle that side of things if I went down that path of something on the Izu Peninsula, although it's a fair way from where you normally operate.
So again, we work with third parties all over the country, so we're ambivalent to where the property actually is. We work with real estate agents, property managers, maintenance, renovation companies, wherever the property might be. We're not the ones actually doing the hands-on work. So from our perspective, it doesn't matter. But I'm just saying that performance and expenses are something that would be quite seasonal, fluctuating, and unstable with a house in the countryside.
Sure. No, I get that. And the actual, you organize if I get an inspection done of the house, you organize that as well?
Yes. So as part of the purchase process, we will do everything from research, although to be honest, because it's a lifestyle choice, you're probably the best filter for research. So we normally forward Japanese websites. We can help you figure out how to translate them so you can drill down on locations and prices and so forth. And then you give us a shortlist. We're also happy to research on your behalf if you've got clear criteria. So we can definitely either assist or do the entire research. We'll do due diligence, negotiations on the price, contact the agent, find out known issues. If the agent can do a remote viewing, then we'll organize that. And then once you submit the offer, we'll put on the offer that is pending a structural inspection. And once the offer has been accepted, we'll go ahead and commission that on your behalf. Okay. And then assuming it might take a few trials and misses until we land on the one, but assuming you finally landed on the one, then we'll take you all the way to settlement.
Okay.
But beyond that, so if we need to research local area property managers that can do short-term stay, put contacts with them in place, organize insurance, utilities, maintenance, all of those things, we just charge by the hour separately.
Okay.
Additionally, if we have to attend in person, then we also have to charge for the trip.
Oh, sure. No, I understand that. I was just wondering, I noticed with a lot of these places in Izu, because it's a hot spring area, they have all these things like hot spring fee, public interest fee, hot spring rights.
But those are resort properties, though. You're not going to be able to rent those out at all.
Oh, okay. So why is that? What's the issue with them?
Well, they're sitting on resort land. There's an owner union in place, and the owner union can specify whether people are allowed to rent out the properties. Definitely not short term, and long term is not something that interests you because you want to use the property yourself.
Yep.
So they're just simply not going to allow it.
Oh, that's good. That's good to know, because that allows me to eliminate that. That's good. And the
and anything that comes with monthly maintenance fees, onsen fees, annual, I don't know, infrastructure fees, those are all resort properties.
Okay. Oh, that's great. Oh, I didn't even know that. That's good. And also, there seems to be a difference between you can own the house but not the land. So when you buy these places, is it a case of buying the house and the land, or am I missing something?
99% of properties in Japan are freehold. If you happen to find one where you don't own the land, that'd be quite rare, and we wouldn't advise on it.
Okay. Oh, great. Now, I also heard, and I don't know if this is true, but there was some talk of increased regulation against foreigners buying real estate in Japan. Do you think that is likely to happen, or is it, and if that's the case, is it better to go into it now?
I have not heard anything about that. Japan is very much a first world country in that it's actually the only place in Asia Pacific that doesn't have any restrictions on foreign ownership. Can you tell me where you found that?
I saw it on a video, a young guy that was talking about real estate in Japan. And that was the first time I'd heard it. So I wasn't sure if it was even true.
I've never heard anything like that. Let me just quickly Google that to tighten foreign ownership of property regulations. I mean, back in 2021, they did pass something about land deals near strategic assets like U.S. Army or Japanese Army and naval bases.
Right.
And sometimes there are historical, cultural, heritage protected areas where people are not allowed to buy. But aside from that, I don't know of anything. Let me just have a look here. And it's tightening regulation. Yeah, the only thing I see is near that strategic assets thing, but that's back in 2021. Oh, hang on. Comments, Japan tightening of foreign investment. Give me a sec.
Yeah, no rush.
I think that more refers to them being wary of Chinese buying property for water rights and so forth. I mean, more screening of who the buyer is, but I don't think it's anything regulatory.
Oh, okay. No, that's fine.
That's all that I can see, at least. Maybe a bit more research, but we've definitely not heard anything of it. Yeah.
Well, do you find that in your experience with your business, it seems to me the interest is increasing. Is that the case?
Yes, definitely. That was that started pre-pandemic, I want to say, but pre-Olympics was really the driver.
Okay.
A lot of people were coming here more frequently. And then through the pandemic, the yen hitting the bottom that it has now, that's even further increased interest. And naturally, the more people come to Japan, the more they fall in love with the country. And tourism numbers have been going through the roof pre-pandemic. So yes, we've definitely been very busy.
Well, let's assume that I did buy a place on the Izu Peninsula that I could rent out part of the year. I was listening to Tracy Northcott's talks about that. But by the way, your material has been really good. It's certainly given me a lot of information.
Thank you.
I guess when people are leaving, say, Tokyo and they go to holiday in the Izu Peninsula, they'd be coming by car. They wouldn't be coming by train, would they? Generally.
Depends on the location. If you're going to Shizuoka City, Izu City, the Shinkansen stops, I think, in Shizuoka, and then it's a local trade down to Izu City itself.
Okay.
If they go beyond that, then yes, they'd normally come by car. But if it's a family, they'd normally drive in any case. Most Japanese families have at least one car. The only people that would be taking the train, I think, would be tourists or maybe young couples and so forth.
Okay. I guess the reason I was asking that was, in terms of criteria, it would probably be best then to get a place that actually had a car space, because not every place has a car space, I see.
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
I mean, from your perspective as well, when you're coming here, you'll probably grab a rental car and want to park it somewhere, right?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. So that was the other aspect of it. Okay, so I'm just looking. I've got a few questions here. I'm just going through. I think you've answered probably most of them. Yes, you were saying that on one of your, when I spoke to you before, you were saying that for these lower end properties, you're probably looking at about a 20% cost incurred.
Correct.
Based on the purchase price. What is the reason for that? Is it just because it's more complicated?
Well, there's a couple of factors there. So first off, it might be slightly over 20% now because we have had to raise our minimum fee to 5% of 10 million yen. So even if you purchase something that's cheaper than 10 million yen, as long as it's a house, we still have to charge you that much.
Right.
So that could bring it up to 20 and a bit. The way it works is the purchase tax as well as the legal and registration fees are dependent on the official evaluation of the property, which is always going to be a bit different to market price.
I was going to ask about that, yeah.
Yeah, and the cheaper the property is, the more the gap tends to be. So cheaper properties tend to rack up something like 5-6% in legal and registration fees, and then purchase tax can go as high as 2.5-3%. And whereas with the properties pricier, the legal and registration fees tend to be closer to somewhere between 1-3%, and the purchase tax closer to 1-1.5%. So in that gap is the difference between, say, 15-20% all up.
Okay. All right. Well, can you just walk me through the payment process, assuming that I signed with you and asked you to maybe a combination of you find some places you think would suit my criteria, but I'd be searching as well, as I have been over the last month or so. What would be the process? Simply signing with you, and then when is the first or full payment due? How do you
to engage our...
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, just dropped out for a sec. Go right. Again.
So to engage our services, there's a couple of documents that need to be signed and witnessed by a JP or COD.
Mm-hmm.
Those we actually need to present closer to when we're signing a purchase contract. So you can take your time with these. But we do also need our fee estimate paid in advance. And we'll base it again, because you're buying a house, it'll be our minimum, which is 500,000 yen plus tax, so 550.
Okay.
That needs, we can do a couple of hours of free research and, you know, exchange correspondence and let you know what we think about properties that you find and so forth. But to actually start researching deeply and contacting sellers and agents and conducting due diligence, at that point, we'll need our fee estimate paid.
Oh, sure. I understand.
And then we start working without any fixed time limit on your behalf until settlement. So you're not going to have to pay us any, you're most likely not going to have to pay us more, because I'm assuming you're not going to go over 10 million yen. From what you're describing so far. So there's probably not going to be any adjustment.
Oh, no, I was looking at, 10 million yen is only... That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which, if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku, or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now, back to the podcast.
Yeah. So there most likely isn't going to be any adjustment after settlement. So that fee is all you'll need to pay for us, aside from, again, separate research or trips to actual properties that we'll need to do. So, for example, if an agent, some of them are still very old school, if they can't handle a remote viewing via Zoom, then we'll have to go in person and do the Zoom for you. In those cases, there will be trip expenses. But aside from that, there wouldn't be anything else owed to us.
Okay.
And then when you submit an offer, the offers are not legally binding, so you don't need to put down any deposit when you're submitting an offer. Mm-hmm. But Japan being Japan, everything is very by the book, manners and procedures oriented. So we would ask that you don't submit five or six offers and then pull back four of them. We'll need to take them one at a time.
Oh, sure. That's unlikely. I would do that.
Yeah. And on the offer, we need to pend any conditions. So pending structural inspection, pending any information that still hasn't been received, that'll all be on the offer. And then if any of the information received is less than satisfactory, fine to pull back the offer. But otherwise, it is assumed that you're going to go ahead with the purchase.
Right.
So once we've got all of the due diligence info, structural inspection report, and we're deciding to go ahead, it'll take from the moment an offer is accepted, if there is an inspection involved, maybe about a month and a half. And then we'll be signing the purchase, obviously reviewing all the documentation before signing, but then signing the purchase contract, paying the 10% deposit to the seller.
10% deposit, yeah.
Yeah, at which point the deal does become binding.
Right.
And so you're not going to get that 10% back if you pull back. And then usually about a month after that, just because there's a couple more documents that need to be signed and witnessed, is when settlement will happen, and then you'll pay the rest of the money.
Okay. All right. So you're probably looking at what, 3 or more months after you've chosen the place?
Once an offer has been accepted, normally worst case, I'd say 3 months with an inspection, maybe 2 months without, but I wouldn't advise to go ahead without an inspection.
No, I wouldn't. No. Okay. All right. And just an odd question. Can you, if you were to rent a place out, can you stipulate no smoking in a place?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, okay, cool.
Whether they'll follow the rules or not is a different matter, but you can definitely...
Well, that's right. You can't really police it. Yeah. But it's just that when I was in Thailand, I complained to this hotel, the smokers were everywhere, and he said, oh, look, legally, I can't do anything about it, which I thought was really interesting.
I've rented non-smoking hotel rooms in Thailand.
Oh, no, you can. You can, but... In the shared areas and often even the restaurants, you know, people can smoke wherever they like. And I've said, have you ever thought about not having smoking there or in this particular spot? And he said, oh, look, yes, I've thought about it, but legally I can't stop them. I thought, oh, interesting.
I'm not sure that's a legal thing. I think it's more of a tourist being friendly to the tourist thing. I know a few places in Thailand that have no smoking signs. I'm sure that's not the case.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, in this case, then at least I can put up my no smoking signs if I want to.
That's absolutely good. Yeah.
And just a couple of last questions. With the apartments, you had a whole bunch of criteria that you look at. And I assume that those kind of criteria would generally apply to a house as well. And I think one of them is like, although it's probably not so possible with Izu Peninsula, but within certain distance from a train station and that kind of thing. Can you just run through those for me, if you can tip off the top of your head?
Yeah, but those are for investment properties, though. Properties that we're looking for a long-term tenant to stay in and low vacancies between tenants. That doesn't really apply in your case. Your case, the primary criteria is a place that you'd find comfortable to stay in.
Right.
And that is obviously not falling apart at the seams.
Sure.
Beyond that, I mean, local property managers that handle short-term stays will tell us what they believe is a good criteria to get potentially more guests.
Right.
So we can maybe, I mean, if it's a prime requisite to make sure that you can definitely rent the property out in your absence, then I think the right way to do it would be to first research local property management companies in that area. Get from them the list of criteria, regulations, compliance, because they would know their market best.
Right.
And then start our property research based on their recommendations rather than go the other way around.
Okay, cool. There was something else I was going to ask about that. Okay. Now, that's probably just about it, I think. Ziv, I think I'll look into it a bit more and just have a look at those local people and see what I think from there. And then I'll get back in touch with you in terms of where we go from there.
Sounds good. Looking forward to it.
All right. Well, thanks for your time today, and thanks for your videos and the communication. It's been very, very helpful.
Pleasure. Glad you're finding value in it. Speak to you soon.
No problem. Bye.
Bye. So that's it. Two very interesting conversations, I thought. Let me know your thoughts in the comments section. Are you in the market for either Akiya properties or investment properties in Japan? Maybe you've already bought one or two. Please let us know. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.